This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Jenna Siri, a bookseller and associate producer of Poured Over, and today I am so excited to be joined by Tana French, the author of such incredible books as the entire Dublin Murder Squad series, my favorite being The Likeness, I just have to say it now, to The Witch Elm, to The Searcher, and now we return to Ardna Kelty and the story of Cal Hooper with The Hunter, and I am so excited to be able to talk about this book, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, Jenna, thank you so much for having me on. It's great.
So I was surprised when I first saw the announcement for this book and saw that we were going back to the land of Cal Hooper and to his story, because I thought we had left him behind in The Searcher. And I was very excited to see his name pop up again, because I knew that there was more to the story. And I was so excited to get more of Trey's story, too, because she's just one of those characters that worms into your brain and like grabs on and has not let me go. So I would wonder how you sort of decided to come back to this story.
Well, yeah, it was a surprise to me too, actually. I was thinking of Searcher as a complete standalone. But when I started to come out of the pandemic haze and think about a new book, yes, I wanted to go back there. And partly it was the characters and the relationships. I felt like I'd left Cal and Trey at a really interesting point where they've started to form a relationship, but it's not solid yet. It's not fixed. And anything that came in to disturb it could throw it badly off balance, and what would happen then. But I also really liked the sort of weird mix of genres that I've been playing with in Searcher, which Searcher is sort of mystery software running on Western hardware. It's a load of Western tropes transposed onto the West of Ireland. And I thought there were just so many that I hadn't played with yet. And I started thinking about, well, what about the whole gold rush trope? You know, there's gold and then there are hills. There is a history of gold being found in Ireland, so that would go well. And I was thinking about revenge, the revenge theme that goes through so many Westerns, and also about the idea of the adventurer who returns home and brings trouble with him in his wake. And I thought, well, Troy's absent dad, who's kind of a bit of a rascal, bit of an early, well, if he came home bringing along an idea to find gold, that would definitely throw Cal and Trey's relationship. What would happen then? And so then I was stuck with the idea and had to write it to find out what would happen.
And I'm very glad that that idea stuck with you, because there's so much in this book that I didn't expect. There are so many moments where everything that we had sort of had the groundwork laid for us in Searcher just got deeper, and this world got richer and more expansive. And there were so many characters that I'm like, oh, yeah, we met them briefly, but now I sort of start to see who they are. You have this very wide tapestry of characters and landscapes that you can play with here. But at the heart of it is Cal and Trey, and I think that they're so important. And the connection that they're starting to form in these sort of years that have gone by that we skip over to get to where we are at the beginning of this book, really, you know, from the first moments that they've sort of settled into something that is laying the groundwork for something pretty big.
I hope so, because that was the other thing that I thought. I wasn't really thinking of this as a sequel exactly, so much as a different angle, because The Searcher was very much Cal's story. He's a stranger who comes to a small town and tries to figure out where he gets into it. But this is a story about a relationship between Cal and Lena, the local woman with whom he's built up some kind of relationship, and Trey. They've sort of turned into some weird makeshift found family, where it's a family structure. It's very much a couple and raising a teenager, and they're not sure how they've landed there, but there they are. And I thought that was a really interesting relationship to explore, this sort of found family, and what happens when it comes under stress, how strong these bonds are, how they deepen through the various stressors that come at them. That was what I wanted to get into. Searcher had touched on the relationship just starting, but this is the relationship when it's deepened and strengthened. How strong is it really?
And that also feels like sort of a Western trope to me, these sort of like ragtag crew of people that bump up against each other and can't quite get away, even though there's a lot of reasons where, they struggle, they disagree, they don't understand each other, and yet there's this undercurrent of love and connection that they also can't quite get away from. And I think seeing Cal sort of grow into his space in this village, and he's no longer just the blow-in, but there's still some things he'll just never understand. And watching him sort of navigate those things in this book is really interesting, because now he's got a little bit more ground under him, but he's still wary of everything.
Yeah, he's never going to be an insider. I mean, this is a timeline where everybody's relationships go back literally generations. Like, a relationship with someone can be based on the fact that their grandfather swindled your grandfather back in 19 God knows what. He's never going to be an insider like that. But he's not an outsider anymore. He's in this weird sort of liminal space. And that is a space that has a lot of power, because he's not bound and defined by the rules of the townland in the way that the real insiders are. But he's not an outsider who can be ignored and dismissed. He's sort of in this strange space where it has a power all its own. And he's not the only one. Like, I didn't realize this until after I'd written the book, but a lot of the characters inhabit that space. Lena does as well, in that she's deliberately distanced herself from the townland set, but she's still from there. And Trey is from there, but she's from a family, you know, that family who the village has dismissed as being basically more hassle than they're worth. And then both her dad, when he comes in, he's also from that family who never quite make insider status. And he's brought along someone who, while he's an Englishman and a definite outsider, he, officially anyway, comes from Ardnacalty heritage. His grandmother was from there. And he's bringing home a secret that's part of their heritage to help the townland. So everyone is circling the townland from this sort of perimeter and deciding what to do with the power it gives them. And they all end up needing to use it, but in very different ways.
And watching those struggles go back and forth, and as new information is revealed, everything sort of shifts into the direction of one person or the other, or one group or the other, or away from everyone altogether in some instances, when things sort of start to really get ahead of everyone. There are so many moments where that's the real tension. I think what I love so much about your books is there is mystery, and there, you know, there may be crimes or things that need to be solved, but the real tension is from how these people interact with each other and sort of the connections between individuals and groups, rather than just here's the mystery and then we solve it. There's so much more.
Yeah, to me, that's always been what fascinates me, that the whodunit factor isn't really a big deal. Now, it's useful structurally, because structure is my strong point. So the fact of having that whodunit matrix really helps me to keep things on track, moving along and in a defined shape. Because, you know, you have A kills B, C finds out whodunit. There's the basic framework of your book. And then you can play with it, but it keeps things in a defined shape. But it's not really what interests me most. It's never the big reveal is whodunit. The big reveal is why, and what effects does it have, and what ripples does it have, and what do you do about it when you find out whodunit? What does this one action mean to everyone around it? And I felt that was kind of heightened when I was writing about a small town, because small towns are so interconnected that everything you do has ripples that go throughout the community. I mean, you can't isolate yourself in somewhere like there. If you live in a big city, basically, if you want to cut yourself off from everyone around you, you just, like, don't play your music loud, make sure your dog doesn't bark, and you're done. But you cannot do that in a small village. Anything you do does have implications and does have effects on other people, whether you like it or not. And so that's what they're living within. And that's what everybody is dealing with. That if they shift agenda, if they shift priority, that has a ripple effect that goes out and out, whether they like it or not.
And so often it's, especially for characters like Trey and to some extent Cal, there's like this survival piece that comes at, if you want to be successful there, if you want to make a life and make a home there, you have to understand it and try. And I think they come at it from different ways. I think Cal's often looking to sort of, when he can, go along with certain things in order to understand. He makes his distinct choices as to when he won't be doing that or when he wants to do something different. But Trey has still that sort of naive piece almost of, like, I can live my own life here regardless of everyone else, and has those moments where it works, but also a lot of moments where it doesn't quite work.
Well, Trey's 15, you know?
Yeah.
It's the natural 15-year-old impulse to go, I am not following any of your rules. I am rebelling. And she's got a lot to rebel against, because in a place like this, this is a place that in different forms crops up in Irish literature, especially Irish drama, an awful lot. is a small town that's so removed from the centers of power that they basically have decided that they have to make and enforce their own rules if they're going to have any kind of cohesive society. And that's what Ard McKelty has done. Here are our rules. You will abide by them. And they're quite heavily, even though very subtly, enforced. You need to do what this townland tells you. And Trey has no inclination to do that, partly because she's 15, it's what they do, but also because this isn't a place she's on good terms with. And when she sees opportunities to fight it rather than bending to it, she takes them. And Cal is aware of the danger of that on every level, you know, psychological and practical and physical. And Trey, you know, she's kind of half feral. She either isn't aware of it or just doesn't care. And he has to deal with that as well.
And there are so many moments where, like, looking back, I'm like, I probably would have felt exactly the same way at 15. But now, you know, removed from it, you can say, oh, you know, you want to say, just make it easier for yourself. But you're also like, no, you know what? Do it. Stand up. Like, show them who you are. I think it's also very interesting. I reread The Searcher and then read this right back to back to sort of put myself very much back in. And there are so many interesting parallels to, I think, the way Trey's brother Brendan is described in that first sort of going, I think so much of how people described him as like, can't think about what comes next, doesn't think about, and Trey's really learning that skill in this book. She's learning how to think about other people. She's learning how to think about how things affect her, you know, relationship with Cal, affect her mother, her father, all these pieces that maybe her brother wasn't really ever able to learn.
Yeah, he never got on top of that. I thought that was important for Trey in this book because she is 15 and there's a big maturity leap that happens somewhere around there where the way you think as a kid, that black and white, I know the next step, I want to do the next step, I don't care about anything beyond the next step. That has to shift, that has to change. You have to start taking into account more things at once and taking into account other people and taking into account the long term consequences of your actions. And it's something that just starts to happen there. And in the course of the book, she does go through a big shift. And by the end of it, she's moved from a kid who just sees what she wants and goes after it bullheaded with all her considerable force to someone who factors in other things. And it's a painful step to make because you don't always want to factor in other things. It means you have to make sacrifices, not just because you're forced to, but you have to make a deliberate choice sometimes to make a sacrifice because you care more about somebody or you care more about, you know, the long-term future than you do about the immediate thing you want. And that's a hard and painful thing to do. And she has to come to that in the end. She has to reach that point. And yeah, it's a fairly big journey for her over the course of this book.
I wonder too, she's 15 in this book and 13 in when we first meet her. And I think probably speaks more in like one chapter of this book than maybe the entire first book. So I wonder sort of how her voice unfolded for you and how it came to writing so much more from her perspective in this story than in Searcher.
Although I loved writing from Trey's perspective. That was probably my favorite because it's a little bit off kilter. It's very much her own. Partly because, you know, the kids growing up have Fearful with a dad who's like even less use when he's there than when he isn't. And a mother who's basically stretched to the very limit, just keeping everybody alive and out of jail. And she's raised herself until Cal and Lena come on the scene and a village that doesn't have any time for her at all. And that's given her quite a defensive perspective and a very alert one where she's always on the alert for threats, for opportunities. She's a half-grown animal in some ways in the first book when she's 13. And by this one, though, she's had 2 years of spending a lot of time with Cal and Lena, running in and out of their houses and, you know, doing things she loves. She's working on carpentry with Cal. She's settled more into the village. She's somebody who I knew had to have started blossoming in a way. So figuring out what that process would be like for her to find a voice that she'd never had before and to find a sense of humor that she'd never had before, to be able to joke with Cal and make fun of, you know, the possibility of him being clean shaven, God, you know, to be able to slag him for things was a big step for her. But it had to wait until that she wasn't aware of it. Cal and Lena can be aware of the leaps she's taken. But at the beginning of the book, at least, she's not really, she's just doing her thing. It's only towards the end that she starts to realize that things have shifted and are shifting.
I agree. I think her voice is so interesting, and I was so excited to go along with her and to sort of see these things. And there were also so many moments where I was like, oh no, ooh, I can feel that something, like when you can see just a half step ahead of her, because when you're 15, you just can't do it. Or those moments where you know she's like choking down these emotions or hiding these things that are just so difficult for her. But yet she's so funny. I do think this might be your funniest book. Like there's so much like those moments that are just like family bickering between the two. Or like I said, my favorite problematic fave, Mart Lavin, who always shows up with something intriguing to say or do. But a lot of other things come along with that as well.
Yeah, he brings baggage. Mark definitely brings baggage and agendas and directions to people. He is a huge amount of fun to write because he does. He has his own agendas. He has his own lens of looking at the world, which is kind of off kilter. And he doesn't care. Like, he does not care if that works for anybody else because he's going to make them work for it and enjoy himself along the way. He's got nothing, you know, he's got no one to protect. No emotional stake in much of anything. He's just going to make things work the way he feels that they should work. And he finds it all, at some level, entertaining. And that's a lot of fun to write.
I imagine that sort of writing all of the scenes with a lot of the people from the townland must be fun to write, like those scenes in Sean Oakes in the pub where everyone is just singing and bantering and having all those moments, or in Noreen's shop when everyone is just sort of gossiping. The tapestry of characters that you've created is so fun to read and get to know and feel like you can sort of start to put the pieces together yourself of like, I think that, that connection there and that gossip there connects those people. It's very fun to sort of go along on that journey.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad, because that's what you want if you write a place like this. You want readers to feel like they sort of know their way around here. They probably know who would get on with who and who would probably be sniping behind each other's back and just how everybody links up. That's a sense that you want readers to get. So I'm absolutely delighted that some of that came through. The pub in particular is just, it's huge fun to write because Irish pubs, everybody knows, they're the social heart of things. And they do come with a huge amount of banter and just slagging each other off. It is the Irish way to express everything from affection through testing each other, through establishing social hierarchies. No matter what you want to do, you just slag each other and it'll all shake down into place in the end. So that was huge amounts of fun to write. I could kind of keep writing those pub scenes for long enough that I had to cutting them down a little bit, because just because they're fun to write doesn't mean you need to read all of it.
And I'm sure there's a fair amount of mysteries and crimes that occur in connection to those pub nights that, you know, we could have our own series there of just what happens after those nights.
Oh my God, somebody should write that, just the After the Pub series.
There would be a lot, I think, to go there. I think especially in these sort of small towns where the town is almost a character in itself, because it has, like you were saying before, it has its own set of rules, its own set of expectations. And I think especially in this sort of landscape, again, that it is isolated. And these mountains and these bogs have their rules too, alongside that there's a lot of nature, I think, that plays into these books in a way that feels very deliberate, and it sort of sets you right in that spot. Even if you're not familiar with where that might be, you're setting a tone for us on what the expectation is in that isolation.
I think that's one of the ways that the West of Ireland is a good match for Westerns, because in both places, the landscape, the weather, the terrain have a very concrete effect on the characters' lives. This isn't just some abstract, you know, oh, the sunset's pretty, I know it's raining, I can't go to the shops. You know, this is something that hugely affects the characters' entire lives and livelihoods, as in a Western, where suddenly, you know, a storm blows up or, you know, there's a drought and you could die. In the same way in the West of Ireland, if the weather goes wrong, you could lose your livelihood. And this is a part of the plot in Hunter, where there's a heat wave going on. And a heat wave in Ireland does not mean, by the way, what it does anywhere else. Like, if it is, I think it's the Fahrenheit equivalent is something like 80 degrees. If it stays over something like that for more than 5 days, it constitutes a heat wave. The whole country goes nuts. We're all outside in the park, turning ourselves bright red and skiving off work to get ice cream. And you know, the papers are running articles about how to survive the heat wave. But for these farmers, it isn't like it is. They're not just skiving off work to get ice cream. It's not like it is in the city. This is a genuine, concrete threat to their livelihoods. A drought means you don't have feed for the winter. You're going to have to buy it. It means the land crop next year isn't going to be great. It's a big deal. And that's one of the things that makes them very susceptible. When Johnny Reddy shows up with this wonderful story about how, you know, this guy whose grandmother came from the townland knows where there's a seam of gold and we're all going to find it and we're all going to be rich forever. It's one of the things that makes them susceptible to falling for a story that, in fairness, in most times, they would have told Johnny where to shove it because they know that Johnny is, on a regular basis, full of it and making up stories either to make himself look better or to get something. So normally they would have had no time for this story, but because this heat wave has them on edge and frightened and backed into a corner, they will take that opportunity to get out of a corner. So the landscape isn't just atmosphere. It plays a concrete role in people's lives.
And I think that's something so different than what we've seen before when you were writing, you know, in Dublin or in these city sort of environments that have their own sort of personality and their own constraints and all that. But this is something wholly different. It feels wild and loose and, you know, very intense in a way that I think we're used to. You know, we all understand cities. We know what a city is like. But this is something together different where there's an edginess to it because for most readers, we don't know the rules of this place. So we're having to learn it along with everyone else.
Yeah, definitely. We're having to learn the rules and we're having to also accept that I'm a city kid myself. I live in the city as well. So for me too, an extra week of sunshine isn't threatening my livelihood. So I have to get into that. Oh, well, no, this is serious. This is real. This is a savage thing that could destroy you, this weather or this landscape. It's not just aesthetic. I think it does make a difference to the entire sort of tone of the book from the earlier city ones where, you know, rain just annoys them.
And I do like this sort of idea that so much of the conflict in this book kind of takes place in this weird moment where hope and revenge and trying to get one over on each other all sort of meet in this powder keg of like, no one really knows where anyone stands on anything. And they're all trying to navigate these really complicated relationships or, you know, interpersonal plays where you never know who you're going to trust. And every time someone gives a little bit of themselves, you find out something different in the next chapter that's going to set all of that off on edge. But I think the sort of revenge on a grand scheme, this Western idea of the mass revenge story of, you know, people versus town versus reputation really makes this a little genre bendy on what a mystery really is.
Yeah, definitely. But I like doing that, you know? I think mystery, one of the whole points of writing in any genre is to take the conventions as a starting point rather than a finishing point. Because let's face it, long before I started writing, people had polished those conventions till they're blindingly shiny. People have written within the conventions so beautifully and so impeccably that there doesn't feel like there's much point to trying to repeat that. The only thing you can do, if you're coming on board when I did, which is, you know, what was it, mid-2000s, I started writing in the woods. And you've got to play with it. You've got to see what those conventions can do that isn't the same thing that's already been done perfectly. You have to twist it, play with it, take it as a jumping off point. And that's, I think, what I've always done. I've always liked that idea that the conventions are your foundation. They give you a strong base. And then you can spin off in all the different directions. It's not a new idea. I mean, Josephine Taylor was doing it way before I was born. You know, there have always been people who've liked playing with the conventions. But I love the fact that the more people do it, the more you have to build on and the more you have to explore.
I know. I've been like, you know, trying to talk about this book to people and being like, well, what if you took sort of a mystery set in Ireland, then sprinkle on Lonesome Dove on the top and And you just sort of imagine a little True Grit. There's a little, you know, there's so many things. And I'm like, but also it's so this specific small town thing. So you'll just come to it and love it no matter what. Just give it a try. Because I do think there's so many of those like conventions that can get turned so easily. I mean, something that I came to years and years later, I mean, The Likeness is one of my favorite books in general. It was the first book of yours that I read. And that is such an interesting mystery. I don't want to spoil it for everyone because I do think it is one of the best mysteries, but that's just me. But there's so many moments where I was like, this is unlike anything I've ever read. And then years and years later, I came to The Secret History by Donna Tartt. And I was like, that's what that feels like. And to sort of have these books that sit in mystery thriller, but have these connections to other works, it makes it so much more fun to read.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, that's huge. For me to have The Likeness and Secret History mentioned in the same sentence is massive, because Donna Tartt was actually one of those people who opened up the idea of genre for me. You got her, Dennis Lehan, people like that, who didn't seem in any way to feel that they had to follow any limitations that anyone had put on genre. The Secret History does follow, in some ways, the structure of a mystery, except that she tells you on the first page who killed who, so then you take it from there. And she also broke open the idea of what was fit territory for a mystery. Like, there's so many mysteries set in families, set within like romantic relationships, set within parent-child relationships, set within workplaces. But maybe there are ones from before that, but I had never before read a mystery that acknowledged that a friend group could be so powerful, so emotionally bound, that a murder could spring out of that emotional web. It was always like, ah, well, friends are just friends. It's light stuff. It's not weighty enough to be the basis for a murder mystery. And The Secret History was the first one I'd read that actually said, no, that place that you can get to with a really close friend group when you're that age, you know, in your college, you're just building that almost pseudo family, that is powerful enough to trigger murder. And that is a fit space for a murder mystery to be located in. So definitely The Likeness, I was thinking of that. I was thinking, no, I think of friendship as an incredibly powerful force. And there is no reason why it shouldn't be the setting for a mystery. There's no reason that you can't lock away a bunch of friends in an old Gothic house the way that other books have locked away the romantic couple or the family within that old Gothic house and have something so powerful come out of that moment.
And I think there are so many things, too, where anything can spark an idea for, especially for something like a mystery. Anything can sort of be like, oh, and now, you know, you could see a sign, or I feel like there was an interview of yours somewhere where one of your books was like, because you had mice. And I feel like that those little moments where it's like anything can spark, especially in that charged genre of mystery in the grand scheme.
I think mystery writers just have a funny mind, right? We are always looking for a potential mystery in everything. And so instead of going, ew, mice, weird, you're going, yeah, but how could this be really mysterious and strange, you know? Like In the Woods was because I was working on an archaeological dig and there was a woods near the dig. And I was looking at the woods going, man, that would be a great place for kids to play. And instead of stopping there like a normal person, I went, okay, so, right, what if three kids ran in there to play and only one ever came out and he couldn't remember what had happened to the other two? What would that do to his mind as he grew up, knowing that the solution's in there somewhere, but he just can't put his finger on it? So I think the mystery writer is somebody who is always seeing if they can find the potential mystery in the little normal everyday things. And that's where I find most of them is going, I know that's not mysterious, but how could it be?
And I think that that makes it so much fun for the readers to come to, because it makes it easier to connect, like, oh, maybe I've never been a police officer. I don't understand sort of the nitty gritty procedurals and those aspects that some books go really heavily into, sort of this is how you solve a crime. But I think that the parts that stick with you and the parts that, you know, sort of creep up the back of your neck and into your brain are the, well, what if, you know, what if this normal day or this normal experience that, you know, you could have had 1,000 times, what if this time something goes left and now there's, this is on your plate?
Well, but it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, how whodunit isn't the big question. It's why done it. What changes something that's been normal so many times? What set of people and circumstances and motivations come together to turn it into something completely else? What you were saying about the mice was, yeah, we had mice. And I saw one first. I was just going into the kitchen, saw one zip across the counter and disappear down the back of something. I yelled, and my now husband, then boyfriend, came in, and he was like, I think you imagine it was probably a shadow. And I was like, no, I saw something. It was something black, and it moved, and it did this. And, you know, it was fine. 2 days later, he saw the mouse, and we got traps, and that was the end of that. But I was thinking, you know, that was fine for us. But what if our relationship hadn't been strong and easy? What if we had been under all kinds of pressures? What if I had started doubting my own sanity over this? What if he had started doubting my sanity? What if this spirals? And I think that is the thing about mysteries, is so many of them are clear that this situation starts so normally, but then just too many little things send it spiraling and suddenly you've got the world.
And that's why I love that your books focus so much on the people involved and less so on the, you know, the inciting incidents in some ways. Sort of, you give us just enough of the grim and grisly to like keep us entranced and to really set the stage. But I love your characters and how they all interconnect. And especially like in your first series, you give us so many moments where all of those pieces just line up against each other. But does it feel differently to sort of write in that big series knowing that there's going to be all these books versus writing a standalone writing now? Or did you not know that there were going to be that many Dublin books? I just am wondering how those all came, you know, how it feels different or the same writing those things.
No, I had no idea there was going to be more than one in the Dublin books. I never even thought of them as a series. For me, they were all standalones. No, I had no idea. I just finished in the woods and I started thinking, well, if by some miracle somebody wants to publish this, they might want another one sometime. And I was thinking about it. I have this idea of, you know, a detective coming across a crime scene where they look exactly like the victim. And I hadn't realized, I only found out later that Tess Gerritsen had already done that. And I nearly died. I was going, oh no, somebody else had my brilliant idea at first. And then realized, no, it's fine. Everybody does ideas differently. Your premise is going to be right. But I started thinking about that and going, well, that's not going to be, obviously, for the same detective I've already written about. But it comes with themes to do with identity and sense of self and, you know, a tenuous connection to the past. And who would that? And I suddenly realized, hang on a second. That would actually fit really well with Cassie, who is sort of the second main character in the woods, who has like a slightly fractured past and who's just gone through something very traumatic at the end of In the Woods. And, you know, that wouldn't be a bad place for her to step into thematically. And from there, it's sort of cascaded. But no, I never have a plan. I don't even know who's done it when I start writing a book. I have like a strong sense of the main character and a sense of the setting and a basic premise. And from there, I sort of jump in there and hope there's a book where I land. I had no idea there were 6 books in the Dublin Murders book.
I love that because I think people think of mystery as this like super structured genre and like that people come in and they outline and they've got all these like beats that they're going to hit and they've got, you know, one of those boards with like red strings connecting things and that it's all planned out in your mind. And I love sort of the freedom of like, well, we're going to find it when we find it, because that's, I think, in a great way how readers feel too, that like, there is an organic feel to how we uncover some of these things that really is fun to go along with.
See, I hope so. That's what I really hope, because I do know writers who have it all planned out, like chapter by chapter. They know what beats need to be hit in every chapter. I envy that because they know there's an ending there. They know before they start writing that all the threads do tie up. And I don't. Like, it's entirely possible that next time I'll start a book, get halfway through and go, there's no book there. But it is what works for me. And I kind of blend on the fact that I come from an acting background. Mm-hmm. So I'm always thinking in terms of the character. The character is where everything comes out of, where every action and every next step comes from. And in order to know like who would do what to whom and why and what would have to move people in different ways, I need to write the characters for a while before I can know all that stuff about how the plot would take shape. So I just have to sort of dive in, start writing them, and then go, oh, no, that person would probably do that, which means that I'll be about a third of the way through and go, whoa, okay, this person did it. And then I have to go back and rewrite for plot factors to make sure that there's enough seeding the plot in to earlier chapters, because you can't just come up with the murder, ta-da, in the last chapter. You have to have everything seeded through. So it takes a lot of rewriting, and I hate rewriting, but I kind of feel like I hope it does have that effect for readers where I'm going, oh man, of course so-and-so did it. And I sort of hope that it might have a little bit of the same like spontaneous quality for readers to make up for the fact that I don't know what I did.
Yes, your struggle is our benefit in the end, because it really provides so much of that enjoyment of like trying to pick all the pieces, but you know you never can get quite all the clues as you go through. And I feel like, you know, the best mysteries are ones where you can guess some things, so you get a little bit of that satisfaction, but the big picture always comes as a surprise at the end.
It's funny because I think that was completely out in the old golden age of mystery. Didn't Agatha Christie and all of those consider that absolutely cheating and not on? There had to be, their rule was, wasn't it the fair play rule, that everything had to be set up, every clue had to be in there, so that if the reader was paying attention, put things together right, they did have a solid chance of figuring out who done it and how and have the pieces to back up their theory. And nowadays, I think we're less into that. I think for a lot of mystery writers, it's no longer a puzzle that you should allow the reader to put together. It's more character journey that you're allowing the reader to come on. I like both. I like reading.
I do too. I think there's something in a story like this where you get some things because it's given and it goes through, but then there's some things that you'll just never be able to get because of the connections between the characters. But then there's some mystery books, like I'm thinking, there's this book by Joel Dicker, The Enigma of Room 622 or something, and it is just this like incredibly long mystery about with a million twists and turns you could never ever guess. But I think if I really went back and like picked all the things together, I could have put it together. And I love a mystery where I got to get to the end and think, should I start it over and see if I can figure it out?
Right. You beat it once for the wild ride and then once for the puzzle factor. I love it. That's like a double layer in there. I think my favorites, it depends on what mood I'm in, because there are times when I want the Agatha Christie. Mm-hmm. I want that sense that I am putting all the pieces together and, oh, look how neat and tidy it came up. But I also want the ones like, you know, a lot of Dennis Lehane's, it's not really that you could put the pieces together, that, because mm-hmm. that's not what it's about. You're on that journey with the characters. You're moving with them. Like Mystic River is one of my ultimate mysteries ever. Or Michael Chabon's Yiddish Policeman's Union. You couldn't put that together. There's no way you could figure out what was going on there. But you're along for the ride and you're in that world and you're with that character. And that's what counts.
Yeah, I think that there's so many ways to read mystery. It's such a big, wealthy genre with just so much to like dive into. And I think sometimes people get nervous because it can seem kind of like isolated, or it can seem kind of like tough to break into. But I think especially with your work, even though there's series, I think you can start on any of them and start, like I didn't start on the first book when I was reading your work. You know, there's so many places where you can just jump in. And once you do, once you sort of get your feet wet and start to understand the rules, it's so much fun to just go through all of them.
Oh, thank you. See, I've never thought of them as series. Linked books, just again, because I wasn't planning a series or anything right. like that. I kind of think of them as the first six, I sort of think of as chain linked books where, yeah, definitely it's going to be fun. Like say you pick up Secret Place, it's going to be fun if you know Frank Mackey already from Faithful Place and you've already seen how he operates. But you don't need to know that. It doesn't really matter. He's, you know, he's fine. He shows up in a couple of them. And the same for this. Like I don't think of Hunter as a sequel to Searcher, more just as almost like there's this village and I'd only looked at it from an outsider's point of view. And there it is with all these secrets and all these intertwined histories. And I should really look at it from that angle. So it's more like a different angle on the same place almost than a sequel.
It's the Tana French extended cinematic universe. It's the Canterbury Tales, but of this village. There's a lot to unpack. And I can't wait for readers to sort of come to all these different characters and pick their favorites and who they you know, I feel like there's so many moments where I'm like, oh, I can think of who, you know, I know someone who's like that. And I have Hi. Those connections to those kind of people. And it's fun to read it that way. But I wonder too, I have to, since you, I have you here, I have to ask. I mean, some of your literary influences, I know we've talked about a little bit of mystery-wise, but I wonder if there's someone, anyone that really influenced this book or something great that you've read recently that you would like to tell us about.
I think this book is probably the same Westerns that I've been in love with since I really recently first discovered the genre, where there's Lonesome Dove, there's True Grit, there's the Sisters Brothers, there's all these wonderful books where you've got people in harsh lives searching for something and not finding it, but finding other things along the way that turn out to matter more. So on the Western level, it's definitely those. But I think probably both Searcher and Hunter, there's definitely an influence of Irish drama in there. Because I read a lot of Irish plays. You know, you're doing that, studying at Trinity and being an actor in Dublin, you're going to read all these. And there's things like Playboy of the Western World and Translations and The Field, which are all the stranger who comes to town, the half insider, half outsider. How do you navigate those boundaries around a small village? How does the village assert its rules in the face of an invader? So I think those are, yeah, Irish drama is definitely a thread through this one. Oh, if it's mentioning something great that I read, this kind of partway read count? Because
yes.
The most recent one is Liz Nugent. I don't know if you've read any of her stuff. She's an Irish psychological mystery writer who does wonderful stuff. And she's got a new one out called Strange Sally Diamond. And I got about a third of the way in and backed right out because Liz is dark and she is so good that you can't shake it out of your head. If she wasn't good, you could go, all right, yeah, the plot's dark, but I'll read it along the mystery and the solution. But she's so good at character and she's so good at peeling back layer after layer after layer. And you understand more and more and more why the characters are who they are and how they've intertwined. And Strange Sally Diamond was just too much for me. It just got into my head to the point where I had to drop it. But any of you guys who are better able for hardcore stuff, it's brilliantly written. It's a really great characterization. You should read it.
I love that knowing of like, you know what? I can see that this is amazing, but I can't do it. I feel like everyone has had one of those books where you're like, I'm going to put this back on the shelf for right now.
I'm a wimp. I'm a complete wimp. And nobody believes this because they're like, you're a mystery writer. You're killing people off every time you sit down to work. I'm like, no, I'm a complete weenie. I don't get freaked out by gore and guts, anything like that. That's, you know, horror stuff doesn't really bother me. It's the eerie things. It's mm-hmm. that sense of something that you can't quite put your finger on. Like, you know, there's been Shirley Jackson stuff that I've just started and gone, no. You know, The Haunting of Hill House. Couldn't make it through because it was creeping me out. And the amazing Sarah Waters, The Little Stranger. It's a great book.
Yes.
It's beautifully written. And it's too eerie. And I want to go back and finish these books sooner or later at a point when it's really bright daylight and everything is locked. Mm-hmm.
You have to wait for that Irish heat wave to go back outside and be like, okay, now I can get through these things because yeah. I've got ice cream and I'm ready.
Yeah. I'm out of the garden. Everything's sunny. There's ice cream. I'm taking on Shirley Jackson.
That's the moment. And I have to ask too, even though I know this is some people's least favorite question, and maybe you don't know yet, and that's okay too, but is there anything on the horizon? Will we see more of Cal and Trey?
It's early enough that I feel weird even saying it, but this seems to be turning out to be a trilogy. And it really didn't expect, but it just felt like after Hunter, the arcs weren't complete, but the characters' arcs, Cal, Trey, and Lena had all started to transform or shift their relationships with this place. That arc wasn't complete, and with each other as well. And also thematically, this whole thing about the village and the outsider and the half outsider, and it just, the arcs didn't feel like they were complete. So it seems like there's one more in there somewhere.
I am very excited by that prospect because I agree I think a great resolution can sort of come from these characters, and there's more to be told. And I will say, this is not a spoiler for listeners, but there's something about a hat that I'm intrigued by.
I promise I will do my best to answer the mystery of the hat.
Thank you so much. That's amazing. But this book is incredible. It is a mystery unlike any other, I think, for people who want something that is going to keep them reading, to keep them interested to hold them and to sort of give them this whole new world of characters to love and hate and everything in between. The Hunter is something truly special. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.